and welcome to the third Global Law at Reading GLA podcast. I'm your host, Dr. James Green. This month we're going to be doing something a little bit different in that the original planned guest for November unfortunately fell through, and so I've decided to do the podcast on my own this month. So no guest to speak of. Sorry to inflict that on you all, but to make it a little bit more fun, I'm going to be talking about a very short article that I wrote as a geeky side piece to my main research agenda a couple of years ago, looking at the role of international law in the first Avengers film, so the Avengers Marvel superheroes big budget film that came out, Avengers Assemble. Because there is a new upcoming Avengers movie in 2015, that seemed like something that was interesting to talk about, and a bit of a fun diversion from some of the heavier subjects we cover on the GLA podcast usually. Back to those sorts of subjects next month, I promise. So the discussion relates to a piece that I wrote called Hero Worship, which appeared in the New Law Journal in October 2012. It was really looking at how international law was perceived in the Avengers film and what that might tell us more broadly. So I'm sort of going to read the piece out, but with some embellishments, and unfortunately don't have somebody to spar with this month. As always, before we get into the podcast itself, just a reminder that you can now contact us via our email. We do actually have our email up and running now, which you'll be pleased to hear. So that's globallaw@reading.ac.uk. Please get in touch about the podcast, about the grouping, if you want to study with us and all those kinds of things. Similarly, you can now tweet us at UNIRDG_GLA. We try and tweet regularly from that account about things going on at Reading, events and so on. So please follow us and comment and get in touch with us that way. The big film adaptation of Marvel Comics' superhero smorgasbord, The Avengers, has broken numerous box office records, and it, as of the end of 2012, was the third highest grossing film of all time. It had also been fairly well received critically, which is all quite impressive, given the number of big-name characters and big-name actors and egos vying for screen time in a single film. It was quite a risky endeavour for Marvel, I think, so it made money, and it actually was quite good. But for me, as an international law academic, Marvel's Avengers Assemble movie, which was irritatingly called Marvel Avengers Assemble in the UK because of Steed and Peel and our version of the Avengers, was of particular interest from a legal perspective. And that's because the Avengers, and especially their relationship with S.H.I.E.L.D., which is the organisation that assembles and directs them, have always set my international law spidey senses a-tingling somewhat. And that big screen incarnation is no different. This is obviously extremely geeky and relates to comic book knowledge, but there's some serious points about international law and the way it's perceived here, so bear with me. So the first thing is thinking about superheroes and the law generally. For the most part, the relationship between comic book heroes and the law is quite an uneasy one. Batman is the best known of a plethora of vigilantes. Superman's actually an illegal immigrant living in America under an assumed name. The Watchmen unrepentantly operate in violation of a legal prohibition on all superhero activity. And the main character of V for Vendetta is a terrorist, albeit one that's fighting against a fascist state. The X-Men is exclusively comprised of mutants, meaning that Professor X is in violation of a number of provisions of anti-discrimination law. And if we think about it, even your friendly neighbourhood Spider-Man's at it too. He's a fraudulent seller of staged photographs. In most cases, though, these characters, these fantastical superhero characters, perform their sometimes very legally questionable acts of heroism in a domestic setting. So that's potentially in violation of domestic law, and, well, let's face it, in the context of superheroes, that's almost exclusively American domestic law. on the rare occasions where a superhero does stray beyond the land of the free, outside of the United States. So, for example, when Batman makes a bizarre brief trip to Hong Kong in Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight, they tend to essentially act on their own behalf. And therefore, their actions would almost always trigger the domestic law of the territory that they've decided to operate in. They generally don't involve international law. Superheroes just don't breach international law. They are individuals acting within a territory. However, for the Avengers, it's quite different. The actions of the Avengers would seem to give rise to international legal responsibility. The group is organised through an institutional command structure which operates globally. In the film, for example, the action takes place on three different continents. And indeed, the events of Marvel's Avengers Assemble not only potentially trigger international law, they're actually a product of it. The Avengers, it turns out, are part of the UN. They're part of the United Nations. In the comics, the Avengers, or to be slightly more accurately and slightly more geeky about it, S.H.I.E.L.D., is inconsistently depicted as being either a covert limb of the American government or as a suborgan of the United Nations. In some stories, S.H.I.E.L.D. seems to have American oversight, while in others it's presented as being a cooperative international body. In Josh Whedon's film, the decision was clearly taken to go with the latter representation. S.H.I.E.L.D. shown as a UN suborgan rather than as a purely American domestic one. Now, that's never made entirely explicit, but it's actually evident throughout the film. Take, for example, the multinational composition of S.H.I.E.L.D.'s shadowy council in a number of the scenes. As such, the S.H.I.E.L.D. presented in the movie, and including its Avengers Task Force, is a creation of international law in possession of its own international legal personality. We're not any longer talking about an unstable individual in a cape and costume, but about an intergovernmental body with its own international legal rights and duties. The establishment of a new UN sub-organ is in itself not all that contentious under international law, of course, with well-known examples being the International Criminal Tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda, both of which were created in the 1990s by the UN Security Council. The creation of S.H.I.E.L.D. would, theoretically at least, be entirely possible under international law, so long as this was properly mandated by the Security Council. Having said that, the UN has never actually had its own military force, of course, despite the dormant provision in Article 43 of the UN Charter concerning the possibility of a UN army. The member states of the UN have always been extremely uncomfortable with the idea of the organisation possessing any kind of independent force, and therefore the UN has had to rely on its members to act militarily on its behalf when necessary, as we're all familiar with. The creation by the Security Council of a covert militarised suborgan such as S.H.I.E.L.D. would be possible legally, but quite simply would be a political impossibility. Okay. Well, so what, you might think? Unlikely as the creation of a UN military suborgan might be, it's presumably still rather more likely than a man who turns into a monstrous green giant when he's annoyed, or a billionaire who's designed his own suit of flying armour. Given that we're in the world of Marvel superheroes here, and therefore are already engaged in a significant extent suspension of disbelief already, one might argue that we should probably just let the political improbability of S.H.I.E.L.D.'s existence slide. Yet, while pinpointing the exact legal status of S.H.I.E.L.D. in the film may seem a trivial exercise, the US government actually took it really quite seriously. It was revealed in May 2012, during the filming of Marvel Avengers Assemble, that the US Department of Defense, the DOD, had decided to withdraw from its consultation role on the movie. The DOD was uncomfortable with the comparative lack of control that the US was depicted as having in the fictional, remember, S.H.I.E.L.D. organization. And the Defense Department's Hollywood liaison, which is a job that isn't fictional, although it sounds like it is, expressed concern publicly as to the representation in the film of the US as a subordinate member of a wider multinational military force. And the DoD was so concerned about this that it decided that it wanted nothing more to do with the Avengers or their film. Eagle-eyed filmgoers might still spot some American military hardware on the deck of the SHIELD helicarrier in the finished film, but for the most part, the Avengers were actually assembled without the US military as a reference point, in contrast to, say, the first Iron Man film, which was full of recognisably American hardware and procedure. SHIELD and the Avengers are both entirely intergovernmental enterprises. SHIELD is a UN organisation, and the Avengers operate under SHIELD's direction. And it's worth remembering that while the Avengers themselves are unsurprisingly comprised of a predominance of American members, including the obviously less than subtle Captain America, they're actually something of a coalition of the willing, featuring, as they do, a Russian and a faux Norse deity. So we're talking about an international, intergovernmental organisation here, and that's something that was so concerning to the United States DOD that they pulled out of any consultation role on the movie. However, despite SHIELD being a UN organ, there are a number of prima facie breaches of international law in the film, and not just by the evil Loki. The Avengers' regular transporter uses of military force, the channeling of mobile phone signals worldwide to attempt to locate the missing Tesseract plot MacGuffin, SHIELD's plans to create a WMD deterrent against alien invasion, and probably most notably the attempted use of a nuclear weapon in New York by the SHIELD Council at the end of the film, would all seemingly constitute breaches of Article 2.7 of the UN Charter, as well as various other provisions of treaty law and international customary international law. Article 2.7, of course, prohibits the UN from intervening in matters which are essentially within the domestic jurisdiction of any state. Military deployment, unilateral global surveillance, and the launching of nuclear weapons would, it is safe to say, all qualify as intervention. Admittedly, the UN Security Council can authorise otherwise unlawful UN intervention under Articles 40 to 42 of the Charter, as we well know, although it can only do so, of course, when there exists a threat to the peace, breach of the peace, or act of aggression, as per Article 39. The attack on Earth by Loki and his Chitauri minions in the film almost certainly constitute all three of those things, a threat to the peace, a breach of the peace, and an act of aggression, and would therefore allow for the Security Council to lawfully pass an authorising resolution. However, any such resolution could be vetoed by any one of the five permanent members of the Council, of course, which, as we all know, includes the United States, and it seems rather unlikely that the Americans would fail to veto a resolution that allowed for a UN organ to detonate a nuclear bomb on Manhattan, or even a resolution that devolved on SHIELD or the SHIELD Council the power to take that sort of strategic decision itself. Given all that, it's ultimately pretty clear that SHIELD's actions cannot have been authorised by the UN Security Council, and therefore that the Avengers were operating in breach of international law at various points in the film. Now, all of this is fun, talking about superheroes through the prism of international law, but there is, of course, a significant amount of inanity in applying real-world legal restrictions to a fantasy film that has no apparent agenda other than to act as escapist entertainment. Indeed, while a number of the Avengers' actions were probably in contravention of international law, they did, after all, save the world. So maybe we can forgive them. But there is a serious cultural point underpinning all of this. The filmmakers clearly made a choice to represent SHIELD as a UN body rather than as a United States one. The latter option would presumably have been the easier course, particularly given the objections of the US DOD. It also wouldn't have actually impacted on the actual content of the film at all. And it could have been justified to geeky superfans, not that I know any of those, because of the contradictory representations of S.H.I.E.L.D. in the comics anyway. They're sometimes presented as a United States body, so it wouldn't have been a stretch for those who keep a close eye on the consistency of these things. The multinational option was preferred, though. It was clearly preferred to point things in the direction of the UN. And for all its international legal failings, therefore, Marvel's Avengers Assemble ultimately presents the UN as saving the day, the United Nations as saving the day, even if it never explicitly says that. That's in stark contrast to the sorts of films, the superhero films that were made under the Bush administration in the United States. During that period, superhero comics and films were consistently keen to deride the UN as an ineffectual paper tiger or as an overly paternal irritant. So take, for example, the depiction of the organisation as merely being the weak representative of the rest of the world in Bryan Singer's 2000 film X-Men, a movie that Anthony Chase's brilliant article charting the representation of international law in cinema references. Such cultural critique is indicative of American attitudes towards the UN at the time, of course, and attitudes that only became more entrenched post 9/11. The new Avengers film possibly highlights at least, a shift in pervading American cultural perceptions of the UN and its potential as a means of maintaining global peace. And that's a positive thought. Although equally the reaction of the US DOD shows that scepticism of a multilateral approach to international relations is alive and well in Obama's America, even when it comes to the world of superhero movies. Overall, though, Marvel's Avengers Assemble seems to take the encouraging view that nations, like superheroes, work best as a team. Now, that's roughly what I said in my article in 2012. Now, since then, of course, there have been a number of other Marvel movies. They put out quite a few. And one of these, one of the most recent ones, in the second Captain America movie, The Winter Soldier, because of the infiltration of S.H.I.E.L.D. By Hydra, the main characters decide to disband S.H.I.E.L.D. Right, so they scrap it. This is a complete turn from the encouraging sort of multilateral way of doing things that appeared in the Avengers movie in 2012. We're back to unstable superheroes running around without any kind of supervision. And this opens up a number of questions for the 2015 Avengers sequel, which is called Age of Ultron. Because there seemingly won't be a S.H.I.E.L.D. organization. The Avengers are apparently going to be funded by Tony Stark, that's Iron Man, and be a private militia, essentially. So that's all of the violations of international law and none of the multilateral elements concerning. I hope you have enjoyed this brief podcast, this very geeky brief podcast where I've enjoyed going back over an article I wrote which inanely applies international law to a fictional superhero movie. It's really a stopgap podcast, as I said. Unfortunately, our guest for this podcast fell through. We will be back next month for episode 4, where the podcast will feature a roundtable discussion of Agatha Verdeboot's upcoming article in the Journal on the Use of Force and International Law, looking at the regulation of the use of force and the incorrect perception of that regulation of the use of force in international law in the 19th century.